Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent Breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from a seedy pub in Liverpool, this is Real Spoilers. As you guys know, this is Joe. I'm actually doing it by myself today. It's just we're going to do a little one-on-one interview. We've actually got on the line friend of the show, Rich Handley. Rich, as I'm sure you listeners know, was on our very first Planet of the Apes episode. He was kind of our aficionado. You may also recognize him. He is responsible for many Planet of the Apes lexicons and timelines, as well as some Star Wars stuff, Back to the Future, which is a... Rich, you can chime in here. That's an undertaking, if I do say so myself.
I basically found myself saying, "Great Scott!" while writing them.
Trying to get the timeline right, whether it's the alternate 1985 or the current timeline, or... You know, where...
Trying to make sense of Back to the Future's time was interesting.
I bet it was.
Well, given that Doc doesn't even seem to know half of what happened in history. Almost everything Doc says about history in the movies and in the cartoons was just wrong.
Oh, you had the cartoons in there as well?
The book covers the cartoons, the video games, the comics, old scripts, novelizations, music videos.
You name it. You but are a dude. That's intense.
Amazingly, I still manage to be married and have children.
Yeah, well, sure. Well done.
Yeah, I don't know how I do it because it's amazing my wife hasn't left me. So. Yeah.
But the one that piqued my interest is actually the last two books, is the Watchmen anthology, the chronology of Watchmen, which is the Watchmen and even the before Watchmen. And honestly, I kind of like the movie. Is one of my favorite reads. It's one of the ones that I probably go back to once a year.
Thank you. I really enjoy. That's actually one of the ones that I had the most fun writing. It, for one thing, it was one of the situations where things lined up the best.
Sure.
Trying to make sense out of Planet of the Apes was kind of akin to trying to juggle nuclear weapons while sticking your face into a moving fan rotor.
Oh, that's simple, huh?
Yeah, and because it was agonizing at times because things simply don't line up from one publisher to the next. With Watchmen, there were mistakes. There were dates that didn't line up and so forth.
Oh, sure.
But making sense out of Watchmen and even the movie and before Watchmen and other things along the way, the role-playing game books, was remarkably easy, and it was really fascinating to see how it all played together. Even though I'd read everything, I'd never done it in that way, and I learned a lot that I actually thought that I knew but didn't.
Yeah, that's kind of the way as, I mean, I am a self-proclaimed comic book nerd. There's always stuff that pops up where you're just like, wait a minute, I feel like I knew that, and now I have no, now my faith has been rocked. Because now
there are
I'm questioning myself.
That can be made if you look at something from another perspective, and you could see a movie 20 times and think, I know that movie left and right. I know all the dialogue. And then somebody will say, but did you ever stop and consider that maybe the main character is an orangutan dreaming he's actually a marigold?
And you're just like,
oh my God, if he's an orangutan dreaming he's a marigold, that changes everything, right?
Yeah, right.
And first of all, you're probably on LSD if an orangutan dreaming he's a marigold is what comes to mind.
I feel like you should be on LSD if you're going to watch those last three movies. Not the current, not the Matt Reeves stuff, but the current, like the original Planet stuff.
Well, it certainly would help with watching the Tim Burton film.
Oh, don't get me started. he owes Kevin Smith a paycheck for that movie. But the reason we're here is because you actually just put out a new book on one of my top five favorite DC characters, John Constantine.
Yes. Thank you for pronouncing his last name right.
There's two versions, right? There's the Constantine, who is the Vertigo character, and then there's Constantine, who is the revamped New 52 version. That's the way I distinguish
it. In other words, there's one version because
I'm not kidding, brother.
52.
Yeah, it's we'll touch on the new, you know, for the people who are listening who don't know what that is. DC is notorious for revamping or rebooting their universe. They did it back in the 80s with Crisis on Infinite Earths. They did it again with Flashpoint, and they're kind of starting to go back to the new 50 or the pre-New 52 versions of our heroes today.
The difference, I think, between the main difference between Crisis and New 52 is that Crisis, in my opinion, worked. It created all sorts of problems in addition to solving some, but it did set the universe on the right path and arguably made things a lot more interesting to read afterwards.
Yeah,
because there was a sense of order instead of complete and utter chaos. New 52 was an artificial construct that didn't need to be done, in my opinion.
I don't disagree at all.
But it really didn't need to be done, and it in many ways, in my opinion, lessened the enjoyment factor. And in fact, it made me a guy who had been collecting and reading everything Swamp Thing and Hellblazer and Books of Magic related walk away completely, and that takes a lot because, as you could tell from our discussion of The Watchmen a minute ago, I am a bizarre completist.
I am right there with you.
Yeah, if I find out that there were a series of 12 matchbooks only released in Uruguay that had one panel comic strips on the back in which Bazooka Joe meets Swamp Thing,
I'm buying it.
I will find all 12 of them and make sense of them in the context of the bigger scheme. So
you are preaching to the choir. My wife loves the fact that I collect comic books, and by love, I mean loathe.
Yeah, well, you know, the key is to find other ways to remind her that you love her, even if you also love comic books.
That's correct. That's correct. So, John Constantine debuted, I believe, was it Saga of Swamp Thing 25?
Yes.
Does that sound right?
Although most people will say 37, he actually showed up in 25 as Sting mugging to the camera in a striped T-shirt.
That's the best. Like, yes. To me, like, the what's awesome about Constantine is he aged.
Yes,
aged,
and that's
throughout that book.
That's why
I agree.
For both Swamp Thing, Swamp Thing's daughter, Faye, and Constantine, it always bugged the heck out of me that they rebooted, because what was really unique about these comics compared to most others around is that time passed. John, at the point that his character should have turned 40, turned 40.
Correct.
At the point that his character should have turned 50, turned 50. When the series ended and he should have been 60, he was 60. And Tefei grew older. Now, granted, in her case, they also pulled a she rapid aged because of plot. But it still made sense in the context of what they were doing. So to have John go from being this 30-something guy in Alan Moore's hands to 60 in Peter Milligan's, and then just revamp it.
Into a 25-year-old.
Yeah, a 25-year-old who kind of spoke the way Dick Van Dyke does in Mary Poppins.
It is, to me...
It was jarring. It was very jarring.
It is very jarring. I think nobody should be writing a British character if you aren't British.
I look at it this way. I'm a British American. My that's my heritage is from England, and I have been reading this comic for 30 plus years, and I shouldn't be writing it. Because
sure.
I know the character inside and out, and it's my heritage, but I didn't grow up in Britain. I've been there, but I certainly couldn't pick up. I certainly could not recreate the right jargon, the right tonal inflections. I too would come off like I was writing Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins.
I think it's more so now in the new, with the revamped Constantine. Sorry, where it just like they try to throw in something that would sound like a Guy Ritchie movie. And it misses the tone completely. Like, it just doesn't work. I mean, the book itself is kind of based in New York and London, bounces back and forth, and it just doesn't sound right.
You know, when you have a guy who's more likely to say, "Hello, governor," than actually talk the way John does,
right?
It's hard to get caught up in the narrative, and that's the reason I walked away from it. And I say all this, I should hasten to add, with no disrespect to the writers.
Sure.
It's just that I'm not a young man anymore. And you know, after reading these things for decades, I think maybe I'm just not the target audience, and that's okay.
I don't think a lot of us are the target audience anymore.
But that's the problem, I guess. Yeah. I have a massive comic book shelf, and I can reread those. So when I sound curmudgeonly and complaining, all I'm really saying is it's not for me. If it works for other people, that's cool.
Yeah, I think like movies or music or comic books, it's a subjective art form. I know that there's stuff out there that I'm still reading. Like, I'm obviously, as soon as Bendis, you put that big red and yellow S on a book, you have my money. It doesn't matter. But now that Bendis is writing it, and I think he's found his groove, it's a really good book. So it's just like, it wasn't for me in the New 52 with his stupid metal suit. But they've gotten rid of the metal suit. They've gone back to the original, sort of. He has like the Man of Steel cuffs, but that's about it. And then, like, that's more my Superman. But I totally get that maybe that New 52 version or the Grant Morrison version where he's rocking a t-shirt and jeans may have been somebody else's jam, but it wasn't mine. Which is weird to say that Grant Morrison on a Superman book wasn't my jam.
That t-shirt and jeans one is kind of like what Superman would be if the creators of Dawson's Creek had
done. He's a hipster Superman.
New on the OC. It's Superman.
I'm sure that the CW would jump at the chance to put Superman into any show, which is what we'll get this year, actually. He'll be him and Tyler Hoechlin, I think is his name, is coming back as Superman, and they're introducing Lois. So that's kind of fun. So let's talk about your book, first of all. So what does your book go over in the world of the 1998 to 2013 Constantine?
Well, DC Comics has come out with a book celebrating the 30th anniversary of Hellblazer, and I know the editor, Alex Gaylor, and so I just happened to be in the right place at the right time to be part of this. Thankfully, basically Alex, who I had worked with Alex when he worked at Boom Studios, helped him put together the 4-book Planet of the Apes archive series. I wrote all the supplemental materials for those. They reprinted all of the Marvel Planet of the Apes comics, and then for each issue, we worked out an order of what should go in each book, and then I wrote background materials explaining sort of setting each story in context. So,
okay, good. I'm glad you brought. Here's my question about that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. If Marvel owns the Marvel, obviously they've put out Conan, they've put out Star Wars, they've put out Planet of the Apes comics. Mm-hmm. When those rights transfer from, like, we'll say from Marvel to Boom, we've talked about this on the show, so we're not really sure how this works. And now with the Disney Fox deal, how does that translate? Like, does Marvel still own the rights to the books that they put out, or does that content flip to Boom?
Well, licensing rights with franchise work is an interesting thing, and it has changed over time. Back then, things were a little sketchier compared to how they are now, mainly because the studios have learned their lesson from the day things were sketchier, and they realized that it got too complicated. But basically, you ask an interesting question, and it's one that I was actually talking about with one of the editors just last week. The Marvel series from Planet of the Apes was done at a time when contracts were such that Marvel ended up partly owning the material. Now, that would seem to go against common sense, which is, if it's the Planet of the Apes franchise, why isn't it owned by Fox? And it is owned by Fox, but that's just the way things were done back then. Marvel retained a portion of the say and of how the material would be used. So when Boom Studio, I have a cold, by the way. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I do too. It's fine. We're going to sound great.
Yeah, sorry about that. we're going to sound like basically a commercial for like nasal medication.
Nasonex.
Yeah, Nasonex presents.
John Constantine retrospective.
Yeah, exactly. But in any case, so when Boom Studios wanted to reprint the old Marvel comics, they needed to get Marvel's permission. Now, if they wanted to reprint something from, you know, far more recent, like, say, Mr. Comics, I have a feeling the Mr. Comics run, which was 2005, was probably recent enough that they wouldn't need to get permission from Mr. Comics. I could be wrong about this.
Sure.
But I believe that it's recent enough that basically now the contracts would state that everything under the Planet of the Apes banner belongs to Fox. And as a good example of this, over the last several years, I also worked with IDW to reprint all the old Star Trek comics. The UK-based comic strips and then the LA Times weekly newspaper strips in America.
Okay.
And, I had to stipulate the LA Times in America as opposed to the LA Times in Spain. Anyway.
I mean, you never know. There could be something.
You never know, yeah. It's a global market.
It's La Times over in Spain.
Exactly. It's not, it's La Times, yeah. that was good.
Thank you. I get one every once in a while.
Hey, he'll be here all week. Try the veal. In that case, that project had taken me years to get off the ground because I kept trying to convince publishers to do it.
Sure.
But everybody was afraid to because back in the 60s and in the 70s when the two sets of strips came out, contracts were a little different. And nobody was quite sure who owned the rights to the material, who was owed royalties and so forth. So Pocketbooks wanted to do it, but they had to pass. Wildstorm wanted to do it, but they had to pass. And eventually what ended up happening was that...
Was Wildstorm pre-DC buyout or post?
I believe that this was post.
Okay.
It was when they still had the Trek license. I think it's... Yeah,
it's
I think that's
it's post probably buyout. Post, I would guess, yeah.
So I figured the third was the charm, and I went to IDW and said, you know, here, I have all this. I happen to have one of the only people I've ever known to have all of this material. Let's reprint it. Most people haven't read it. And they were able to – I guess their legal team was able to work their way through all the contracts and determine that, as a matter of fact, yes, Paramount owns all of this.
Interesting.
So that was what was – what allowed those five books to be done was – that they were able to determine that everything under the Trek banner, under the Star Trek banner, belongs. Well, it belongs to Paramount these days. It's Paramount, CBS, and my Uncle Henry.
Yeah, right.
Who knows where it's going to end up eventually? But it anybody who has the license can now reprint it if I understand things correctly. So that's why, for example, Eagle Moss purchased the rights for reprinting these old comics, and so its graphic novel collection has been running the gamut of all the publishers because it all belongs to Paramount and CBS.
Gotcha. So with the Fox Disney deal,
mm-hmm.
Does Marvel Comics now get the rights to the Predator comics that were at Dark Horse and the Alien comics that were at Dark Horse? I mean, they've already taken the Star Wars run away from them.
That's a good question. The Dark Horse stuff was the 90s, right?
Up until current, I believe they were still putting stuff out. I think because there's a... I'm pretty sure there's a James Stokoe book.
When it started.
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
It wasn't the late 80s, right? It was the 90s?
Not that I'm aware of.
Then that's recent enough that the contracts may have allowed for just Fox to own it, period.
And
they decide who gets to reprint it. But I could be wrong simply because, look, for every contract, there's another version of a contract, right?
Right, sure.
So it's certainly possible that things were different. I could never proclaim myself to be a contract expert. The only reason I know what I do is from having been in on some discussions or having been told about some discussions regarding the Star Trek and Planet of the Apes stuff. But it's not my area of expertise. Even a couple years ago, I would have been asking the same questions you are. So
sure, sure.
I could be totally wrong, and if there's a comic book lawyer listening to this going, that guy's a freaking idiot, then
I appreciate that you think our reach is that far.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, back to the character and the man of the hour. Well, everybody kind of knows the DC has been trying really hard to make Constantine a thing.
Ever since the Keanu Reeves movie when it was mispronounced.
Yes, and that's to me, that's
and
it.
For those who don't know why we keep stressing teen and time, it goes back to the days of Alan Moore. He created the character, and then at one point he had somebody refer to him as Constantine, and he said Tyne rhymes with wine.
Yeah.
And there have been a few instances since then where John has actually made a point of correcting people and saying how his name was pronounced. So anyone who's a longtime fan and has paid attention to this realizes that his name is Constantine. Well, when you take a Brit punk rocker from London or Liverpool, depending on when you're talking about, and sure. you transplant him to the United States and make him a sullen guy in L.A., might as well also drop Tyne rhymes with wine.
May as well. Why not?
And call him Constant Dude.
That's about who he was, too. Like, yeah. It was really just like if like Bill or Ted had, you know, fallen on hard times and gotten to the occult.
Well, I'll even say this. I actually, and this is apocryphal, I know, I like the movie.
Oh, man.
But I'm going to have a huge disclaimer on it.
Okay.
I think it's a horrible Hellblazer adaptation.
Okay.
If I had never read Hellblazer, I think it actually has an interesting story and some interesting characters. The reason I like it is because to me, because it's not called Hellblazer. To me, this isn't Hellblazer. As an occult movie about an occult detective fighting demons in a really unusual type of setting with some pretty damn cool depictions of hell.
Yeah.
To me, it's interesting.
With
as a Hellblazer film, it utterly fails.
Yes. It is. I mean, it's got Shia LaBeouf in it.
And that is one of the areas it utterly fails. And in fact,
he's Chaz, right?
As Chaz, yeah. And that to me is the worst thing about the film. I'm not even somebody who rags on LaBeouf because he's done some good work. But
yeah, sure.
He is not a man Constantine's age, you know, because I'm using the Keanu version of the pronunciation there. He is not his age and is not his, you know, longtime best friend who drives a cab and has – well, he does drive a cab, but but he's not this gruff bruiser of a guy. In the comic, Chaz is the non-occult analog to John. He's the one piece of normalcy in the comic. But he's an everyman type. He's a guy who gets he's a little flabby in the middle, but he could also punch through your face.
Correct.
And he's kind-hearted and generous, but cross him the wrong way and he'll break your arms.
Shia LaBeouf.
That's not Shia LaBeouf who played this. Honestly, if I had never read the comic, I might have even enjoyed the character. But this teenage John worshipping groupie type was strange for a cab driver, I might add.
Right.
But putting that aside, it's just about as wrong as you can get for the character as the TV show version making him immortal. Now, I like the TV show version.
I think Matt Ryan there's very few times in comic book casting has an actor looked and sounded like what I thought the real Constantine or Constantine would be. It's Matt Ryan.
I think he was fantastic, and I hope that if they have any intelligence, they keep using him, which they apparently are.
Yeah, he's in it for it.
And I even think the guy who plays Chaz was a good choice.
Yeah,
It disappointed me that he doesn't sound like him, but but the immortal thing really threw me because. I mean, it worked in the way they did it, but with Chaz, the thing that mattered, the thing that made him such an endearing character, in my opinion, was that from day one, he was the one thing in Constantine's life.
I know, it's tough, right?
Yeah. Damn it, DC. Anyway, you've made it be impossible for me to say a sentence without self-correcting, but He was, I'm going to say John. There you go.
Yeah, that'll work. Yeah, we can do that.
He was the one thing in John's life that wasn't in the occult, the supernatural, the hidden world, as John Shirley referred to it in the Hellblazer novels. He wasn't part of this. He was a guy who knew John because John had helped him fix a problem, and they had stayed friends.
Sure.
And but his wife wanted nothing to do with him. Chaz kept John separated from his daughter and granddaughter. Because John was dangerous to those around him.
John is what happens when you reveal your secret identity to the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, and he puts everybody he loves at risk.
Exactly. And so even though Chaz will jump right in and help him when needed or drive him everywhere, Chaz typically is the guy who drops him off at the scene of a demonic avalanche and then leaves. And then later on, someone, you know, does something that makes John say something flippant and Chaz punches him in the face.
Correct.
But he's not immortal. He doesn't have supernatural powers. And that was the one aspect of the show that irked me.
Yeah. And so we should say that there was the NBC show in 2014 that starred Matt Ryan. And that's kind of where Matt Ryan has found his convention groove, because now he is Constantine forever. He was on Arrow for a minute. He was on Legends. I think he's going to be a regular character on Legends.
Yeah, and he's also, they're doing an animated series that continues where the TV show.
Oh, good. Yeah, City of Demons.
Well, sort of. I mean, they go back and forth. City of Demons, the trailer is out for it, the animated movie. It stars Matt Ryan, so you would think, well, it must be a continuation, except Chaz is different. I mean, there are things about it that make me say, I don't see how it's a continuation. I think it's kind of like Dame Judi Dench and Daniel Craig Bond.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right? I mean, she was M during the Pierce Brosnan years, but it's clearly not the same character.
But it leads to the fact that James Bond is not one person. James Bond can be multiple people.
This is a topic for a long protracted thing. We're going to totally sidetrack ourselves. Right. I will just say this. I've never bought into that, and I'll tell you why. The movies themselves kind of make it clear that everybody from Connery up to Brosnan must be the same guy, and here's why.
Okay.
Because Connery has a bunch of adventures. Mementos from which Lazenby keeps in his drawer and fondly takes out. If they weren't the same guy, then that would make Lazenby's Bond a real weird, creepy stalker type who has a case of hero worship and says, you know, gosh, that Connery Bond is the kind of guy I want to be. I'll hold on to all his mementos in my drawer.
That's why he was now, only Bond once, because he was crazy.
But that's just the tip of the iceberg, because Lazenby Bond marries Tracy.
Right.
When she dies, Connery Bond goes and finds Blofeld to seek revenge, which would be weird if he weren't the same guy, but it doesn't stop there.
Was that Never Say Die, Never Say Never Again?
No, Diamonds Are Forever.
Got it. Okay.
So then it doesn't stop there, because Roger Moore sadly visits Tracy's grave and For Your Eyes Only and takes out Blofeld as revenge after – and Blofeld is now wheelchair-bound like he was at the end of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And – After a Roger Moore Bond visits his grave, Timothy Dalton Bond refuses to catch flowers at Felix Leiter's wedding because the death of Tracy has made him not want to get married again. Pierce Brosnan Bond is chided by Terry Hatcher's character for the fact that the pain of his past has made him unwilling to love. In other words, and also I should add that all five of them have exactly the same relationship with MQ and Money.
That's true. That's
true. So we have to, if we accept that they're five different people, then M is a curmudgeonly dick to five different people.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is why Rich is responsible for the chronology of Back to the Future and Planet of the Apes and Watchmen. Like, this is legit. You're getting some good stuff.
Because I'm insane, that's why. we have to accept that Q gets exasperated and on wit's edge over five different agents. And that Moneypenny really has a very easily led heart, because she falls in love with and flirts with five different agents who take the name James Bond.
She's just attracted to the name.
That last one, I was just going to say, I could buy that she's got a James Bond fetish.
Right. Actually,
you know, oh, you're the new Bond? Hello there.
How you
know,
doing?
How are you doing? I could buy that one. But the whole idea that all of them have a thing for Tracy.
That's probably, okay.
And that Lazenby Bond keeps mementos from Connery. That one's actually really amusing. Like that, we're off track here, but like I find that to be the funniest one because I could see, okay, maybe the five Bonds are friends, and
right,
so that's
right.
Why Moore is visiting Tracy's grave. Maybe Dalton and Brosnan were so affected by their friend Lazenby losing his wife that they won't get married. Okay, fine.
But bros Lazenby, before hoes, Rich.
Right, but Lazenby holding on to mementos from each of Connery's missions is freaking hilarious.
Yeah, that's pretty
because
good.
Because that means he's kind of secretly in love with Connery. Right?
And honestly, James Bond Connery era, who isn't?
I guess that's true.
Yeah, I mean, come on. You're not going to get much better than that. So back to Constantine.
We're gonna eventually discuss Dark Constantine.
Maybe. What was your first interaction or first time you saw or read a Constantine comic?
Okay. Well, here's what happened. Back in the let me think about this for a minute. I guess it was the late 90s.
Okay.
My friend Joe Bongiorno and sometimes collaborator Joe Bongiorno, in case he's reading this, I mean listening to this, had gotten into Swamp Thing.
Okay.
And he said to me, oh, you've got to read this. Now, I had, you know, I was younger. I'd seen the USA TV show. I'd seen the two movies. It's not that I didn't think Swamp Thing was fun, but to me, Swamp Thing at that point was goofy. It was very goofy. I even had faint memories of the cartoon, which is a disaster.
It is a disaster, and with a great cover of Wild Thing as the theme song.
Yeah, just awful.
Yeah.
But a Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
See, so I'm 36, so that was my introduction to Swamp Thing.
So then you know what I mean.
I do know yes.
Yeah, so I mean, that's why I say I only had a faint knowledge of it, because I'm 50, so I wasn't watching it because I'm 14 years older than you. But I had a memory that it had been on, and that I'd seen a commercial or something and gone, What the hell? And it only ran five episodes, so you couldn't have been watching it that long.
No, it was one. There was a Rambo cartoon. It was Swamp Thing, Toxic Avenger. Like those were all kind of together.
So they're all the same caliber.
Yes, basically, yeah.
But Joe kept pushing me to read Swamp Thing, and I kept saying, yeah, but you know, he's oozy and he hangs out in a swamp. His name is Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Just like, first of all, his name isn't Swamp Thing. Okay. I mean, I know it became that like 100 issues into the run. He started calling himself that. The first time he calls himself that, I facepalmed. But initially it was just, it's like Hellblazer. John's name isn't Hellblazer other than one or two alternate universes where he's a superhero. You know, the Doctor is not named Doctor Who. Swamp Thing initially was not named Swamp Thing. It was just a title. And so when Joe explained this to me, I said, okay. And he came in and he handed me at work the first House of Secrets 92 and then the first 10 issues. And I read House of Secrets 92 and went, well, yeah, it's a little simplistic, but I like it more than I thought I would.
Yeah.
Then I started on the Len Wein era and came in the next day and said, I read them all. Can I have more?
So please, sir, may I have another?
Please, sir. Yeah. So what ended up happening was I ended up reading the entire Swamp Thing series 1 and 2.
The Len Wein, or had you gotten to Alan Moore yet?
Well, all of series 1 and 2.
Got
so
it.
Everything from Len Wein up to oh my goodness, Mark Millar.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, for
the
sure.
The whole thing, like, in short order, because everything that existed at the time, which was...
By the way, thank you for pronouncing Mark's last name correctly.
Ah, there you go. But, so everything from Wein up to Millar, I read all of it and immediately wanted to read it again, but I didn't feel comfortable asking Joe, can I start collecting, borrowing all your stuff again? So I actually tracked it all down and then told my local comic shop, anything new that comes along, I'd like it. And they said, how about Hellblazer? And I thought about it and said, all right, I now know what I'm going to collect.
He'd only shown up twice, right?
Or, oh, no. He's,
he was a regular character in the Alan Moore run.
Yeah, he showed up in 25 as a grinning, mugging Sting, and then in 37 as a speaking role. He was throughout the American Gothic storyline, which was 37 to 50, and then every writer after that, from Rick Veitch up to Millar, had brought him in at some point. So I had a pretty good feel for the character, even though a couple of those writers fell into what you and I were talking about earlier. A couple of the writers were really on, had him speaking, and I won't say who because I know some of these people and I don't want to. but a couple of them had him saying things on the caliber of hello Gofta.
Yeah, sure, sure.
But the stories themselves were good, and so I said, you know what, screw this, I'm doing it, and apologize to my wife because we would still be able to somehow pay the mortgage while I went out and collected all of what I had missed on Hellblazer. Loved that too, and then I just kept reading it. And then I said, well, Books of Magic.
I mean, may as well keep going, right?
Yeah, if Books of Magic first spawned as a John Constantine story, screw it. I'm tracking down all the Books of Magic. And it just sort of went from there. I mean, And there are periods of Swamp Thing and Hellblazer that I don't consider great, but I think it's hard to say
in 300 issues, right, you're not going to have some fallow periods.
Yeah, there's going to be some points where you just sort of smack your head and say,
right,
really, I shagged a lesbian? Really? Really, a trench coat that comes to life?
I got to tell you, I love that story.
I it seems to be one of the more polarizing ones because I know people who absolutely adore it. And others who absolutely hate it. I'm kind of in the middle. I think it had its charms. It was a cute idea. I don't know that it was that well executed. And so I think I might have liked it better for example, the characters that he has the coat going to are kind of one-dimensional. I think that may be part why I didn't open up to it. But the bigger thing for me is I didn't like the coat's characterization.
What we're talking about is
a strange statement.
What we're talking about is during the Pete Milligan, Giuseppe Camicoli run, which is those two gentlemen finished the book. There's a story where Constantine's coat is possessed itself because of all of the crap that John has put this coat through throughout these entire, 30 years of stories. It finally has like a life of its own, and it became like possessed by a demon.
What you just said is exactly why I didn't like it, and I'll tell you why. It's easy for people to have overlooked this, and I know Milligan clearly did, which is no disrespect to Milligan, but he forgot that John didn't have the same coat throughout all those years. His coat was destroyed, and S.W. Manor bought him a new one. He'd only had it about 10 years, and yet John and the coat both seem to think they've been together for 30.
Interesting. Okay.
It kept knocking me out of the story. I kept saying, but that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. You know?
Interesting. I never put that together. Very good.
And the truth is, had I not put that together, I might have liked it more. I think that it kept bugging me that they clearly, but even the coat thinks that it's 30 something years old. And I thought, well, no, that coat got destroyed. S.W. Manor bought him a new one.
Interesting.
And I was like, damn it, I wish he'd remembered that. Because the fact that I did remember it made it hard for me to take it seriously whenever the coat kept talking about, making references to things it could not possibly have experienced.
Yeah, also the coat talked. Like, we'll just put that out there
That right there was what when I said before, the characterization of the coat, which is not a statement one normally makes.
Correct.
You don't normally refer to, I was watching Batman yesterday, and I got to tell you, I wasn't happy with how the cowl represented itself.
You could get away with a talking coat in Constantine, though. I feel like you could get away with a talking coat in a Constantine.
Anybody could, it's probably this.
Yes,
And I do understand what he was going for. I mean, the idea is that after 10 years of being around a person performing exorcisms and getting covered in ectoplasm, if you're using Ghostbusters talk,
that's right, yeah,
doing all the things that he does, that the coat became tainted. And it's not a bad idea. I actually could, that's why I say that I was somewhere in the middle. But every time that the coat would talk, I don't know. It just, also, I thought the resolution was kind of dumb. The coat just Yeah, I'm going to go back to my other guy. I spent the whole storyline talking about how John is unsuitable and he's unfit to wear me, but you know what? I'm going back to him.
I feel like that story, because that storyline takes place as that series is wrapping up. I feel like Milligan had another story he wanted to tell, and that was the marriage of John and Effie and their relationship and fighting through all of John's crap to be a couple. So I feel like they had to wrap that trench coat story up.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe if they had been given more time. But I'm glad you brought that up. So for me, it's a Simon Beasley cover was sitting on a shelf at my local shop, and he had like the first, I don't know, not the first 10, but like a 10 issue run that was just sitting there. And I've known about John. I knew who he was, but I'd never read a book. And so I picked up those 10 and I burned through them. And I was like, same deal. Please, may I have some more? and I went back and I started falling into, I went back from issue 1. And I started with the Jamie Delano run, which was a little hard to get through, I'm not going to lie. Like, that was not what I was expecting. But by the time I got to Grant Morris, or to Garth Ennis, and I was like, oh, here it is. Like, this is what I've wanted all of my life. And obviously, Preacher is top 3. Like, Preacher is one of those comics. It's, you know, it's on AMC now, but if you ever get a chance, go pick up. I think there's maybe an Absolute edition or maybe two, but there's all kinds of collections on the Garth Ennis, Steve Dillon, Preacher run, and it's.
I reread it every year or two,
it's so good.
I second your recommendation. It is one of the greatest things I've ever read.
To me, so like my top 5 are Kingdom Come, Preacher, and then honestly Superman Birthright by Mark Waid and Lionel Yu. Those are kind of the 3 that I always tell people to go read. I mean, Batman Year One and The Dark Knight kind of speak to themselves, and Watchmen is kind of on another level. But those are the 5 that I'm just like, if you want to start reading comic books, this is where you should start. Sometimes people get through Preacher and they're just like, what are you thinking? And I was like, well, you weren't ready for that yet. You're a little, you're unseasoned.
You know, one of the things about Preacher, as I find, because I reread it a lot, actually, is unfortunately parts of it have gotten dated. It's inevitable. When it came out in the '90s, there were certain attitudes that have changed.
Yes.
And so when you read it now, some of it seems a little on the quaint side, and that's not to the detriment. I'm not saying that it's not still readable, because it absolutely is. It remains one of my favorite things. But one thing, I think the TV show has been all over the place in quality.
Parts of it have been horrible.
But one of the things I do like that they did, and frankly, given the unevenness of the show, it may be purely accidental that they did it right. But one of the things that I like that they did was treat the quaintness as quaintness. So in flashbacks, Jesse has the mullet from the comic, for example.
Right.
But not in the current day when he has like this little pompadour thing going on.
Yeah, he's got the hipster version
of the
mullet.
Right, and so I kind of like that they recognize there are certain things that are quaint. Like they've had some fun with Hairstar's hats, for example.
Yeah.
Tulip in a recent episode went under disguise, and I burst out laughing because she had the comic character Tulip's hair.
Right. Yeah. So I feel like that's like one of those Easter eggs.
Yeah, know? Exactly. Yeah. So they were, which is why I say that the way that they've treated the quaintness of it may be accidental. Maybe they were just going for Easter eggs, but it's one of the things I think they do right, because they it prevents the show from coming off as corny. If you had, and those of us who love Preacher probably would have loved seeing Jesse, you know, with a mullet.
I kind of hope, like, where they said it, it felt like they could do that and get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, but it just didn't. And going back to talking about casting, the dude that is the vampire.
Cassidy.
Cassidy, thank you. I was like, that can't be right. is pitch perfect.
There are certain characters I think they've gotten right. The three that got it are fantastic. Cassidy, Hairstar, and the Allfather.
Yeah,
I think
that's a good call. Good call.
Oh my God! All three of these guys are exactly what they look like, what they're like in the comic. The only difference is that I love the deadpan delivery of the guy who plays Star, because
he
basically is what I hear when I hear Star's voice in my head while reading it.
Yeah,
it in my head there's a slightly deeper timbre to it, but that's nothing. Like, the point is, he so captures it. When they introduced the Allfather, I actually burst out laughing because. As you'll agree, I'm sure, the Allfather, much like Humperdoo, is one of the most – by the way, I love Humperdoo. One of the most cartoony aspects of the comic.
Garth Ennis has a – like, so this – I will say that Hellblazer made me fall in love with Garth Ennis. From Hellblazer out, if his name is on a book, same way as that big red and yellow S, I'm buying the book.
Right.
Some of his stuff isn't – on the level sometimes. He works at some companies that don't really have the bank account to pay a decent artist, and I'm not disparaging. Those guys draw better than me.
That much is noticeable, definitely.
Yeah, but Garth Ennis has this dry and dark sense of humor, which it lines up perfectly with Constantine.
And with Steve Dillon's art.
Oh, my God. And rest in peace.
Steve Dillon was made to work with him, yes.
I can name, like, again, five creative teams that the synergy with those teams is palpable, and Ennis and Dillon are probably number one.
And that is why I say that, why I loved Humperdoo and the Allfather, is that one of the things that Dillon had some fun with on Preacher was that certain characters, the more ridiculous ones, he would draw in a very hilarious way. So you had Jesse and Tulip looking like normal people, but Humperdoo looked like something out of Mad Magazine's Don Martin strips.
Exactly, and it's the same thing with their Punisher run.
The Allfather kind of looked like the Liberty Bell in a coat.
Yeah, that's right.
TC looked like something out of Deliverance. And so it was, to me, these characters were hilarious. And so I wasn't sure how they'd come across on television. So when the Allfather shows up and he looks like the Liberty Bell in a coat, I cheered. I said, oh my God, they actually did the Allfather the way he's look. And Humperdoo looks totally different.
He does.
But that's because nobody in the real world looks like a Don Martin strip, so there was not much they could do with that. So
the fact that they got Arseface into that show.
They did, although...
They had to change some stuff.
I'm of two minds about the background. They've changed so much on Arseface that the only thing he has in common with him is that he has a hole in his head.
That's true, yeah.
Right? I mean, he's for one thing, he's hideous in the comic. He's a cute guy. And, girls might swoon over this guy.
I don't know how they're going to make out with him, but I'm sure he'll figure it out.
Well, probably not that. But, I could see girls saying, oh, he's good looking, even with the hole in his face.
Hole in his face, yeah.
Right, and so that's... But I think the actor does a damn good job. I'm not fond of the way he's been written. Where what the hell is Hitler doing in the show, for example?
Yeah, that's fair.
Why does he spend all of his time in hell? You know, his storyline from the comic is almost entirely absent. But
which makes me worried for their Invincible run. Invincible is one of my favorite comics series of all time, and Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg picked up the rights to that as well. So
God,
here,
why does
DC
keep letting Seth Rogen do this?
I don't know. Hopefully, to me, Invincible is a movie. Like, you need a budget to do Invincible. Invincible is basically Spider-Man meets Superman.
Yeah.
So you need a big budget to do that movie. And I don't know if that's going to happen on TV.
Well, the only thing I can say is that at the end of the second half of season 3 of Preacher was wonderful. They finally found their stride. Everything involving the Grail and Star and Daronique, and especially the vampire cult, which is the one thing the show has done that I thought worked better than
the comic. Movie. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Because the oh my goodness, I'm drawing a blank on his name. The other vampire.
You got me. I'm a season behind.
Oh, okay. But you know the comic, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so you haven't met the Allfather yet?
No. I mean, I know he's in it. Look, with the internet and spoilers, I know.
So you've seen him?
Yes.
Okay. He is pitch perfect. The way the guy talks, the looks on his face when he's talking to Star, and he knows that Star is lying to him. Everything about it is right out of the comic. And the suitably over-the-top nature of a guy who weighs 4,000 pounds or whatever he weighs, it works remarkably well. But one of the things they brought in that I honestly figured they'd probably skip was the vampire cult. You know, and in the comic, it's kind of a one-off thing. He meets a vampire, and the guy's kind of a prat, and he decides, I don't like this guy, and he hangs out with posers, and I'm out of here.
Right.
But in the show, it dominates the second half of season three, and it's one of the best things they did, because Akaris, I couldn't think of his name. They make him a far more interesting character. The guy who plays him is fantastic, and the characters in the cult are interesting. And so this is one area where I think, and your listeners may be in an uproar thinking I'm crazy if they don't like Preacher, but I think this is one case where they one-upped Ennis and Dillon, and I never expected to say that Seth Rogen.
That is a tough thing to do.
It is, because it's because one, it's Seth Rogen.
That's true. It's like,
and I don't mean that to slam Rogen, but he's not Garth Ennis in terms of writing. So the fact that storyline, in my opinion, was actually better, it kind of makes up for the whole pointlessness of Cassidy and his son in season two. Season two to me was a mess because there were so many plots that just went nowhere and had nothing to do with the comic.
Yeah, I almost gave up.
I came close, but then I figure I'll see how season three goes. Season three starts off not good, but within about two episodes, you go, huh?
Oh, this there it is.
Oh, yeah. Oh! And then suddenly, like, you think I actually for the first time feel like I'm watching the comic, and it took damn long enough.
Yeah, but sometimes it does, unfortunately.
Yeah,
and some shows don't make it, like Constantine.
By the way, they also make God a character this season, and he really is okay. Taking out the stupid cow outfit that he's wearing.
Sure.
Or not cow. I'm sorry, it's not a cow. It's a dog, right? Yeah, dog.
Oh, it's a dog. Yeah.
I forgot because he's not wearing a mask, just the spots. So I'm picturing cow, but I realize no, it's a dog.
Right.
But putting aside the stupid dog outfit, because in the comic he's always a buff guy in a who right. Without a shirt on. But putting that aside, I think the guy who plays him is wonderful. Like they seem to be realizing what they were doing wrong. They also bring in the devil. Like all the fun stuff that was missing from the show.
In the second season?
I'm sorry?
And the fun stuff that was missing in the second season, they've added to the
third
season?
Yeah, it seems like they suddenly realize, why are critics ripping us apart?
Right.
Oh, we don't have the characters that is created. We have our own cast instead. So suddenly in season three, Darnique and the cult and the devil and God all become part of the story, like they should have been.
Right, yeah, from the jump.
Yeah, and so anyway, we have derailed ourselves.
But you know what? But the listeners of the show know.
It's still Edison Dillon.
Exactly.
So.
The listeners of Real Spoilers know that tangents are what we do. So
maybe
it's quite all right.
We should just rename the show Tangential Spoilers.
Well, see, now you've trademarked it, and now we can't use it. So great. But
that's looks like with Fox giving everybody permission, all the Planet of the Apes stuff. I give you permission.
Oh, thank you.
But Ennis and Dillon, by the way, just to bring it back into the Constantine area.
Yeah.
Ennis and Dillon, that's my favorite era of Hellblazer.
It's a great – that I remember reading
almost
that.
Almost nothing about it is bad, in my opinion.
No.
Almost nothing.
To me, their run is perfect.
It introduces my all-time favorite of John's love interests, Kit Ryan.
She's wonderful. The fact that we have not seen her in anything –
Well, she shows up in the Milligan run, but only briefly.
Well, I mean, like in the current stuff.
Oh, I see.
You know, like she's the girl that got away.
I'm kind of glad though, because I think other writers would screw it up.
That's probably true.
Kit Ryan is the only time
Is she the Irish gal?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Kit Ryan is pretty much the only time I've ever seen a comic book character and thought, if she were a real woman, I would fall in love with her.
She, like, and everybody she's writes, like you're exactly right. Yeah, like, obviously Lois is unattainable, or Carol Ferris, or Selena Kyle, but Kit felt like a real woman.
And along those lines, Brendan Finn, whom she was married to,
yes,
is one of my all-time favorite friends of Constantine.
Yeah, that's tough.
Of Constantine. Yeah. It's what?
That's tough. Like, that relationship between Brendan and John and Kit is all, yeah, like, it's
heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking.
But he also introduces so many other great characters, Rick the Vic and Heather.
Oh, man. Rick the Vic
Mage
is one of my
the
favorites.
Rabbit. There are so many great characters that he introduces, and so many great stories. But he also is the only writer who really got First of the Fallen right.
Yeah,
because he created them. The yes. ones that came later, you know, some of them really just took him in really doofy directions.
He would, yeah.
Oh, you know what? I got to take that back because I actually really like what Paul Jenkins did with him too.
Paul but Jenkins after that, has an underrated run.
Paul Jenkins is my second favorite run.
Oh, interesting. Okay, see, yeah, it's Milligan for me.
I love Paul Jenkins. Milligan's run, you know what's funny? I've reread all of Hellblazer several times, sure, and each time I come away with a different take on each writer. Because when I read everything through, Delano was the entry point. I loved Delano until I read Ennis.
Right, okay.
Because Delano was so different than how Swamp Thing did it that I was really intrigued by the idea of John as a very different person than what I thought he'd be.
Right.
But once I read the Ennis storyline, I realized how meandering the hippie thing was.
That, so, it's...
Yeah.
Delano is one of my least favorite runs. Because,
but there are aspects of it I really like. I really like the character of Mercury, for example.
Oh, absolutely! But to
Mercury
me,
is fantastic. And by the way, if I don't know if you've read John Shirley's two novels,
I have not.
But Mercury comes back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he brings back briefly Rich the Punk and Kit Ryan, but he brings back Mercury as a main character, and that was fun.
Interesting. I'll have to go find those.
There's... And those are part of the continuity. Those are not outside the show. Okay, well, there's one caveat.
Right,
the
only, yeah.
The one thing that John Shirley did that does jar things is that he seems to have conflated Lucifer, rather, and the First of the Fallen.
As in, he puts them together?
Well, in that there are references to Lucifer being First of the Fallen, but but the truth is, half of DC's writers make that same mistake.
Sure, sure.
Over all of the who's and the encyclopedias, they really seem to confuse the fact that they're not the same guy. So I just sort of shrugged it off because the books are fun, and they fit very well into the continuity of the comics. So seeing Mercury come back was great, but other than Mercury, I agree. Oh, the other one is Josephat P.O. Flynn, which was one of my favorite Delano things.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that was good stuff.
Jerry the guy who ended up being sucked into the world of literature, yes, by Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, right. So that's
that
the
was
stuff
wonderful.
So to me, I compare the Ennis run to the Joe Kelly run on Deadpool. Just stick with me. The Fabian Nicieza and Rob Liefeld run on Deadpool created that character, right? Like, okay, they gave you that he's the merc with the mouth. They gave you he was a mercenary. They gave you the look, but the Joe Kelly, Ed McGuinness run on Deadpool gives you the version that we know now, right? Okay, like, so Joe Kelly and Ed McGuinness are responsible for the Ryan Reynolds movie, the sense of humor and all of that, like the characters, the blind gal, like all of those characters come from the Joe Kelly, Ed McGuinness run. The version of John that I fall in love with is the Garth Ennis, Steve Dillon John. Jamie Delano and John Ridgway gave us the character, and they gave us a version of the character where I feel like Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon give us the version that I love.
When I was working on this book for DC, one of the things that they wanted me to do was to write four essays breaking up all of Swamp Thing and Hellblazer into four eras and discussing what each writer on the series up to. It, by the way, the book covers stops at New 52. It's just for the best. Yeah, it's just about the New 52 era. So they wanted me to discuss how each of the writers approached the character, what they brought to the title, and so forth. And then at the end is a 30 or 40 page chronology, just to show you that I'm still up to my old tricks. There's a 30, 40 page chronology that does for Hellblazer what I did for Back to the Future and Watchmen and Planet of the Apes the timeline. And that took a lot of work because I had a far fewer pages to do it. But the reason I bring this up isn't self-plugging, but it's because it's relevant to what you were just saying. One of the things I talk about in these essays is that whether or not you like each writer, each one adds something new. So Alan Moore introduces us to a man of mystery.
Yes.
And Rick Veitch humanizes him a bit more. Jamie Delano gives him a background and makes him a vulnerable person and gives him friends that we don't know. It gives us Chaz, for example. Then comes along Garth Ennis and gives him cancer.
Yeah. That is one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And gives him true love and gives him an arch nemesis, but makes him a hard drinking man who, Delano had given him a drug problem, right. but Ennis makes him a hard drinking pub crawler.
Did Ennis make him bisexual, or was that always a thing that kind of floated under the surface?
It's interesting you ask that. It's one of the things that, it's one of those things that, that I discussed in the essays. The origin of it actually goes back to Delano, but it's subtle.
Okay.
It's when his friend – you remember his friend Raymond?
Sure.
The older man.
Yeah.
When they – again, like there are parts of Delano I really enjoy, and Ray is one of them. I think Ray is a really great character. When he's killed by gay bashers, yeah. It was Harper.
Sure.
John's narration throughout Hellblazer always offers some very interesting insight into him, and it gave us most of the revelations that he's bisexual. And the first one is very early on. I could be wrong, but I think it's issue 7 when we meet Raymond and he says, or Monda. I always pronounce it in my head as Bond. I've never heard anybody say
that's it. How I would say it too.
Yeah, it's Monde.
Right.
I'm assuming it's pronounced Mond. And I would love it if somebody would correct me if I'm wrong. I'd like to be pronouncing it correctly. But he refers to how he's known Ray for years, and how Ray it's never gone beyond platonic because Ray was in love with a soldier.
Ah,
now the implication of that statement is if Ray was not in love with a soldier, it might have gone beyond platonic.
Right.
So that's the first hint, and there are a couple of little things involving Ray. Who was it? Is it?
I'm looking at a panel right now, and I can't. The panel is basically it's John's inner monologue that says girlfriends and the odd boyfriend. They all have a nasty habit of walking out on me. A couple of weeks, and they've had enough. The mystique gets shabby. The jokes turn to digs, and the sex goes stale. Your lovable he's sitting down.
Sitting at a laundromat, right?
Yeah.
That's issue 51. It's by John Smith, who's the first person to come right out and say it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they lean into that in the reboot. He is involved with an African American man, and then there's a big story that goes along. It was a big deal, and people made a big kerfluffle about it. But it's the same people that didn't read the early. It's like when they made Alan Scott gay, and people were up in arms, and it's just like, how many Alan Scott fans are there really?
Well, here's the thing. In my opinion, the worst thing about fandom is fans.
You're preaching to the choir, brother.
The worst thing about movies and TV shows are viewers. The worst thing about comics and novels are the readers. And I just alienated every single person who's listening to this. But
no, not me.
Here's why I say this. Take Star Trek. Star Trek, ever since its inception, has been a show that has preached tolerance.
Yeah.
It has preached equality, openness. It has preached progressive values. So what does half of fandom seem to have a problem with? A black woman at the center seat of Discovery. A black man, a captain of Deep Space Nine. A female captain on Voyager.
A woman who's playing a gay character who isn't gay enough.
Yeah, the fact that there are gay characters on Discovery.
Right.
All of this stuff are things people have complained about. People will say things like the idiotic comics gate movement.
Oh, good Lord.
all of that stupid shit.
Yeah. This is by the way, you feel free to cuss. Like, this is, okay, yeah, good. You're good to go.
But I've been holding off.
No, it's all you.
Well, in that case, fuck. Yeah. Okay, so all of that nonsense is being dished out by people who don't understand the very thing they claim to be fans of, because comic books and science fiction and fantasy, almost by definition, with the exception of a couple of strange anomalies, tend to be progressive in thinking. The whole idea behind, and political, very political, but political in the stance of anti-fascism.
Sure.
So anti-racism, anti-misogyny, anti-bigotry, anti-Islamophobia, all of this stuff. When I see people saying, the comic book equivalent of Make America Great Again, ugh, I think to myself, why are you even reading this?
Your stuff isn't going away, right? Like, if you want to go read a male Thor comic, go buy the trades. There's a great run by Walt Simonson.
It's like what I said about New 52. If it works for people, fine. Between Swamp Thing and Hellblazer and Books of Magic, I've got close to 900 comics I can reread at any time.
Sure, and it doesn't go anywhere.
It's a long time to do it. It's not going anywhere. If I'm not getting new stuff in that continuity, well, you know what? That just means I can reread the other stuff and pick up connections I missed.
Yeah. If it doesn't click with me,
yeah,
I just won't pick it up. And it's not because, again, it's a subjective art form. You know what? I read Jason Aaron's entire run. I have never missed an issue of his Thor run. From The Jump to Jane Foster, spoilers, sorry. Thor, because I like if you can give me a new version of, you tell the same story for Thor or Superman or Batman, it gets old. But if you can tell me that Dick Grayson's Batman or Jane Foster is Thor or Bucky Barnes as Captain America, spoilers, probably not for Infinity War, but who knows? I'll take those stories because I love comics. I don't care if going back to the Alan Scott thing, Alan Scott isn't even a blip on my, I know who he is, but I couldn't tell you the last time I was excited for a solo Alan Scott story. So the fact that you made him a gay man with a husband, I don't care. Like, you didn't change the fundamentals of the character. You just changed one aspect to maybe make him relatable to somebody that doesn't have a character they can relate to.
I felt the same way with Star Trek Beyond making Sulu gay. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, why not?
On many levels, of all of the original Star Trek characters, he's the only one who wasn't shown having a love interest at some point.
That's true.
And so there's nothing to say he's not. I know people will say, yeah, but Mirror Sulu had the hots for Uhura. Well, okay, Mirror Sulu is at least bisexual then. So what? Right.
Well, maybe it wasn't the hots. Maybe it was like there was a, a mutual friendship love between the two,
Mirror Sulu wanted to basically rape Uhura. I don't know that.
Well, all right then.
About that friendship, but
that's fair. That's not friendship.
Yeah, he was sort of basically saying, "Sleep with me, so that when I become the captain, I can do well by you."
Oh well, all right.
It was a power thing.
That's a little Harvey Weinsteinish, but all right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know that I would call that friendship.
No, it's not.
But other than that, the only time non-Mirror Sulu ever showed any interest in anybody was when he thought he was D'Artagnan and he called Uhura, fair maiden, I will protect you. That's it. And that's just because he was D'Artagnan and she was a woman, and that's what D'Artagnan does. Like, it's not an indication he was straight or gay.
Right.
And so, for me, the fact that they made Sulu gay did not violate anything.
Nope.
There's no point at which Sulu said, I am a street man. So,
that's right? A very good Sulu impression, by the way.
Thank you. So,
there it is.
So for me, it added something new. And if you read the comics from IDW, Sulu having a husband and daughter actually worked into the plot in one story.
So IDW puts out the movie-verse comics?
They do both.
Okay.
Actually, the funny thing is, for those who only watch the movies, there are three Kelvin Universe stories, right?
Got it. Okay.
But that's the tip of the iceberg, because IDW, ever since the first movie, since 2009, has been coming out monthly with one or more stories.
I used to work in a comic shop, and we had two, maybe three guys that ordered, that on their pull list was every single Star Trek comic, Like, it just said, I remember looking at the list, and it said Star Trek, and in parentheses, it just said all.
Yeah, that's
so,
me.
So, right on. Well, those guys were the Star Trek guys and the Doctor Who guys, and we had one guy that would get every cover to those Doctor Who comics.
Oh, I don't do the alternate covers.
Oh, my God.
You're charging me to buy 12 copies of the same
comic.
then screw you for asking and screw me for saying
well,
yes.
Well, so I have partaken in the variant covers depending on the artist, but I hear you. I'm not like the Batman 50 issue, the wedding issue. I mean, when you look at it, they had like, I don't know, 30 different covers. And I was like, I'll take the Art Adams one and the Jim Lee one. Thank you very much. Yes, I'm good. But yeah, so like talking about this character, who are some of the creators, in your opinion, we'll give it top three, and top three writers, top three artists, who have done the best version of Constantine?
Okay, the writers, no matter what direction the comic goes later on, I will always have a soft spot for Alan Moore's version of him, because Alan Moore gave us him.
Yeah.
And I, when he shows up with a speaking role in 37 as this smoking, trench-coated asshole who seems to know a whole lot more about Swamp Thing than Swamp Thing does, I was immediately intrigued. And one thing my friend Joe had said to me when he coerced me and bent my arm and made me on threat of my descendants live read Swamp Thing, he said, just wait till you get to American Gothic. And so this guy shows up, and I'm already still, after 17 issues, I'm still reeling from the fact that Swamp Thing was never Alec Holland. I'm still recovering from this.
Well, they've gone back and forth.
Yeah. But I mean, so I'm still like sitting there going, wah, and then, and then that happens.
Yes.
And I he shows up, and I think to myself, what a cool character. How does he know so much? By the way, one thing that becomes clear when you reread everything of Hellblazer and Swamp Thing over and over, we really don't know how he knew this.
Nope.
It's actually he's never again shown to be an expert on elementals outside of Swamp Thing.
No.
He's never somebody.
Well, they kind of reference it in Justice League, the comic, Justice League Dark. It's kind of kicked around, but that's New 52. That doesn't count.
Yeah. What I mean is, in the history of the pre-New 52 run, there's never a point where he's – well, actually, I have to rephrase that, because he is an expert on elementals in the John Shirley book. So there's that. But other than that, there's not a point where he's saying, you know, if only the elementals were here. I know. I'll go help a water elemental to discover she's a water elemental. Right, like there's never anything like that again.
No, there is not.
It's strange that the very reason that John was introduced is an abandoned plot point.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, but you're right, because he would have basically become the elemental catalyst.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
You need an elemental.
Go
have John talk to him. Yeah. So we're gonna make a bubblegum elemental. Go get Bazooka Joe and John Constantine. He'll teach him how.
We're on the way.
Yeah. So, but putting that aside, Alan Moore. Actually, the interesting thing is basically the first three dads that he had would basically be the first four. Alan Moore, Rick Veitch. Not, you know what? I'm wrong about that, because Jamie Delano is not.
It is,
so yeah. Alan Moore, Garth Ennis, and Paul Jenkins by far.
Okay.
Like well above everybody else, in my opinion, are the three best at writing him.
And for me, it's Garth Ennis. Pete Milligan gets a mention because he is my introduction to John. Like, he gets bumped up there because his run was the first run that I read. And then it's a toss-up. Like, I really like Jason Aaron's Young Punk John.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that run, I think, is those few issues that he does. But I'd have to agree that Jamie Delano is it's Garth Ennis, Jamie Delano, and Pete Milligan, with Alan Moore coming in at, like, 3.5, you know?
So in other words, you really like how he writes John, even though you don't like Delano stories.
Correct. I think he gives you the foundation of John.
Yeah.
You know, he gives you the building blocks, and then Ennis builds the mansion.
Totally agree with you on this.
Yeah.
Delano's John became a vulnerable person, and that was the first time that I realized I actually liked the guy. See, and I love the character under Moore, but it's not someone I'd hang out with because he's kind of a jackass to people.
Right.
Whereas Delano made him a vulnerable person, and you start to see why he's the way he is. It's a cover up for being for having an unhappy family life, for losing friends left and right. It's a facade he puts up because he gets people killed when he's nice.
Yeah,
to
that's
him.
Exactly it. Like anybody that gets close to John is gonna die. Like that's just
and that,
kind of
by
the
way, one of my favorite things in all of Hellblazer was meeting his cast of ghosts and how it kept getting larger as time went on.
Yeah.
Because Brendan joins it and Rick DeVic joins it and so forth. And as far as Milligan goes, it's interesting that you point out that Milligan was your introduction. You see, when I was a kid, Roger Moore was my introduction to James Bond. Now, I'm old enough that I was alive during the Connery era.
Okay.
But on HBO and so forth, I tended to see the Roger Moore films, and so he introduced me to them. And then very quickly, I started watching the others. So I loved the Roger Moore films until I saw all the others.
Ah.
So Roger Moore was my entry point, but I very quickly discovered that the Connery films and Honor, Majesty, Secret Service are far better.
Which is that is a bold statement for some non-hardcore Bond people. The Honor, Her Majesty's Secret Service is one of those ones that gets left off a lot.
Well, you know, it used to be. These days, a lot of people have reevaluated it, and I'm glad because, I know we're totally tangentializing
now. That's what we
now.
Do. It's all good.
And I just made up the word tangentializing. I'm going to put a little TM after it. So I expect royalties if you use it.
From Real Spoilers, definitely.
Here's my opinion on my totally unsolicited, unexpert opinion on why the Lazenby film didn't go over well. These days, when a new actor is announced for Bond, we're already speculating who will replace that actor.
Yes.
So Daniel Craig comes along and they go, oh, I'm looking forward to the Daniel Craig run. I hope Mel Gibson gets him next. No, I'm joking. I don't hope Mel Gibson. But the point is, we're saying 10, 12 years from now, here's who I want to replace him. Back then, it was very different. Connery comes in at Dr. No. Now, diehard fans know that wasn't the very first James Bond. But
correct.
In terms of the film series, strangely enough, not only Barry Nelson, but Roger Moore had predated him.
Is that right?
Roger Moore played James Bond in an episode of, what was it called? Mainly Millicent? Oh, I think it was called Mainly Millicent. It was a sketch show kind of like Carol Burnett.
Okay.
And Roger Moore played James Bond in an episode of that before Connery.
Interesting.
And Barry Nelson did it in the 54 Casino Royale. So, but then Connery comes along and becomes the role. So here's what happens. They make 5 movies with him, and then he leaves.
Right.
At that point, I think if God had played James Bond, people would have said he's not powerful enough.
That's probably true.
If Hitler had played James Bond, they would have said he doesn't have enough strength of conviction. Right?
That's very – yes.
So it the problem is that Lazenby, who was not a seasoned actor, steps into a role, a really beloved role.
Even back then.
Yeah, played by a really beloved actor. And he was rejected, in my opinion, because he wasn't Connery. But the movie has so much going for it. And anyone who's sitting there going, that Hanley's a fucking moron, needs to rewatch the movie. Forget Connery while you're watching it. Just watch it. It's got one of the best plots.
It does.
It's got the best of all the movies, the best Bond girl. Tracy is fantastic.
Yep.
It has one of the best Blofelds. The music, the soundtrack to that film is unreal. And so what ends up happening is they bring back Connery and Diamonds Are Forever is stupid.
It's not good.
And then they move on to Roger Moore. But what has happened at Roger Moore is we have now had 3 actors
in three
actor changes since Connery left twice. By the time Pierce Brosnan come along, we've all gotten used to the idea that Bond is many different actors.
Right.
So at this point, we accept them all. Now, I know there were people who said, Daniel Craig, he's blonde, blah, 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 the whole
James Blonde.
That's stupidity. The point is that right now we're saying, oh, there's another film coming. I wonder if Idris Elba is going to replace him.
Sign me up.
Right. So that's the thing. So at this point, we are very accepting of other actors. I think the biggest problem Lazenby faced is he simply was the first one to change.
That's, look at you. Like that's. You need to talk to, Lord knows, whoever owns the Sony, I guess now. That's who owns James Bond, I think. Talk to them. See if you can get yourself a James Bond book going, my friend.
I would love to.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And so there you go. That's my pet theory. I think if Lazenby had been the third or fourth, he'd be a fan favorite.
Interesting.
I also think if he hadn't had I interviewed Lazenby years ago for Cinema Fantastic magazine.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he told me was that he really regretted leaving after one film. He had done it because he took really bad advice.
Oh.
Someone had really bolstered him up with the confidence to expect to be paid on the level of Connery and to be, you know, he was new to it. He was not a seasoned actor, and I think he did a very good job. I know not everyone does, but I really like his performance. But I also think Roger Moore in Live and Let Die is not his best performance.
No.
Connery in Dr. No is not his best performance. In other words, had Lazenby stayed with it, he would have become another Connery or Moore because he would have grown.
I do notice you don't mention Dalton in this run.
I happen to love Dalton.
I like the first Dalton.
I think Dalton hit it out of the park from the get-go. And so to me, I have no problem with Dalton. I think Brosnan was a great choice, but I only like one of the Brosnan movies, which is
that's true.
GoldenEye.
Well,
GoldenEye is
great. Was he supposed to take over at Dalton, and he couldn't get out because of Remington Steele?
You know, it's amusing. Each of the actors who have played him have been connected to the character before playing him. So you have Roger Moore played him before he became Bond, Mainly Millicent. I think I may be misremembering the show's title. I think it's Mainly Millicent, but it's something Millicent. So Roger Moore. Then you've got Tim Dalton, who had been offered the role at one point, but he felt he was too young.
Okay.
Then you have Pierce Brosnan, who was offered the role, but he couldn't get out of Remington Steele. So each of these actors, the one difference is Lazenby, who hadn't been offered it previously. But otherwise, these actors all were connected to Bond, and then later on played him later.
So we should say, back to Constantine, there has been a plethora of top-tier talent that have worked, writers who have worked on this book. Brian Azzarello, Warren Ellis, Grant Morrison.
Yes.
And obviously we've talked about Pete Milligan. Just to name a few who are the guy, Jason Aaron is another one, who cut their teeth on Constantine. And I think
it's a stepping stone.
Yeah, and which is a weird thing to say, but look at their runs. Like Jason Aaron is spotty because he drops in and out, but Azzarello had a long run, Warren Ellis had a long run, Milligan finished the book. And Grant Morrison, I think Grant Morrison was also one of those kind of ones that would drop in and out.
Grant Morrison had only a couple issues.
Yeah.
Neil Gaiman had one.
Yeah, that's right.
Eddie Campbell had four.
Right. So it's kind of a who's who of current
talent really
today.
It really is. And then you've also got the miniseries, you know, and the one shots and the graphic novels. Yeah. So there are stories outside the main comic that are written by Cy Spencer and other, one of my favorites.
I have Sean Murphy. If you don't know who that guy is and you're not reading comics, go pick up Punk Rock Jesus. Go pick up The Wake. You can pick up Batman White Knight, and he's working on something else now, but he's not really saying too much about what it is. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that. I just want to add that some of my favorite Hellblazer stuff is outside the main comic.
Sometimes it is,
I absolutely love the 2000 annual Suicide Bridge.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah, you're right.
I absolutely adore all his engines.
Yep.
The graphic novel. Dark Entries is one of those overlooked graphic novels that from Ian Rankin. It is a must read, especially in today's climate, because It equates reality TV to hell.
Yeah, and which isn't too far off.
Exactly. it tends to be overlooked in discussions, I've noticed. But I recommend highly getting Dark Entries. Pandemonium is a strange one from Delano. It came back years ago.
Yeah, that is a weird one.
It's beautifully drawn. It's kind of oddly written, but I like it. But all his engines in Dark Entries to me are fantastic. Suicide Bridge. As far as the miniseries go, I have a soft spot for the Papa Midnight miniseries, even though it totally contradicts.
It does a little bit. That's true. there's a Papa Midnight series. There's a Chaz series.
There's a late
one. By Phil Noto, I think.
There's what?
Phil Noto, I think, was the... That might be...
Yes.
Is that Jamie Delano as well? No?
No, Jamie Delano did the Bad Blood.
That's right. The one that got pulled.
It was published. Bad Blood. Yeah, Bad Blood takes place. It's called Bad Blood, a Restoration Comedy, and it takes place when Constantine is an old man. It's actually a really interesting story. I think it might be the first miniseries of Hellblazer. The idea is that in an alternate future, Britain has become truly fascist. You're not even allowed to say negative things.
Right.
And Lady Diana has become worshipped as a deity.
Oh, and honestly, we're not too far from that.
Yeah.
You know?
that is true. I was actually in Britain a month ago, and people really like Diana.
Yeah, she's a big deal.
Yeah, so... The Lady Diana is considered they call her oh my God, I'm drawing a blank. It's not the lady. What do they call her? I can't think of what it is.
I don't know.
Whatever it is, she has this title. There are statues and people come to the shrine of Diana to worship. They bob their hair like hers and wear her.
Oh, wow. Outfits.
And what ends up happening is that Constantine, as an old man, ends up decrepit, living in this ghetto, because
let's be honest, where would he end up?
Where would he end up exactly? Right. Because if you're someone who refuses to stop smoking and stops swearing and stop drinking and stop being a bad person, you're not allowed. You're not afforded things like living in the city outside the grotto. You have to the ghetto. You have to live in the ghetto. You're not given health care. You're not allowed to do things. Kind of like Starship Troopers. If you don't serve, you can't vote.
Right, right, right.
It's that kind of thing. If you're not a good citizen, you don't get to do pretty much anything other than live in shit.
Huh.
So he befriends a woman who, in the midst of all this, the last surviving heir to the throne of England dies.
Okay.
And this group of aristocrats decides that they're going to manufacture a new Diana by presenting the world with a television miniseries about the long lost bastard offspring of a royal prince. And they just say the prince. They don't tell you which one, probably because they don't want to get sued by the royal family.
Yeah, right, right. But there's some people you want to go to war with. I feel like those probably aren't that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it turns out that it's Constantine's friend. And so Constantine gets caught up in this effort to protect his friend from being used and abused by the British monarchy for the sake of creating a new British monarchy.
Okay.
And it's a really unusual and subversive type of story. It's probably, in my opinion, Delano's best work on Hellblazer.
Interesting. I was thinking of Shoot First. Which is the Warren Ellis one shot?
Oh, Shoot! Yeah, Shoot!
Yeah, Shoot was the Shoot, one that got pulled.
That's the one that got pulled. And that's it. You know, it's funny. For years, I had heard about it because, like everybody else, I was curious what it was.
Right.
I mean, we all knew it had been pulled, but the story wasn't available, and so this mystique built around it that it was going to be the second coming of comics. And when it finally was, if it was released online for years, pirated, but then it was eventually released by Vertigo.
It was like a Vertigo 100-page special or something like
that.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good story. Honestly, I don't think it's his best one.
No, I would agree.
I was surprised at how non-monumental it was. Now, that's not putting it down. It just
because of the way it was built up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was hyped a lot. It's an enjoyable story. I think DC made a mistake when they pulled it.
Yeah, probably.
I get the thinking behind it, though. I mean, at the time, the Columbine had just happened, and there were other schools. The school shooting every day thing that we have
wasn't a thing.
Wasn't a thing, yeah. But it had started.
I remember I was
every couple of weeks. Like it was starting at that point.
Was that 99? Columbine was 99?
Yeah.
So I was a senior in high school when that happened.
So there you go. So yeah. Columbine is the one that drew attention, but there were others at the time. And because of all the attention Columbine got, DC felt very uncomfortable about publishing a story in which the main character says these kids are dying because they're choosing to stand there and be shot.
Right.
And so I get why they were reluctant to do so. What I would have done would have been to talk to Ellis and say, listen, keep writing. we will publish this in a year.
Right. We're not gonna get rid of it. We're not gonna shit can it.
Right. But we would be really insensitive to Columbine families if we published this now.
Right.
But it's a good story, and you're actually making an interesting point that should be delved into. And so, but it would be insensitive. So please, by all means, keep going. We will schedule this in when the time is right. That's how I would have handled it.
They didn't. They put it out 10 years later. Like, it was a long time before that came out.
It was a long time after it came out. And I'm glad that they did. But it is strange to see that one standing on its own, because it's not nearly as standalone in terms of a big event.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
As it became by being set off from the rest of the title.
Right.
Whereas things like Pandemonium or All Our Engines or Dark Entries or any of the miniseries are events. These are things, or even Suicide Bridge, because it's an annual. These are events. These are bigger stories. Shoot is not a bigger story because it wasn't written as one. It was written as just the next issue.
Correct. It reminds me, there was a run of Blade that came out right around the movie. And each issue was a one shot. They just told a self contained story. So it kind of reminded me of that, where it was just kind of, I feel like it may have been just like a filler issue. They're just like, we need to give whoever was on the book at that point just maybe a little bit of a break. So do you have a story? And Ellis, I'm sure, pumped that out, because Ellis is a fantastic writer. I'm currently reading The Wildstorm by him now, which started off a little shaky, but now that we've figured out what we're doing with it, it's like, oh, this is super interesting.
I have to admit, I haven't read it, but it sounds interesting.
It is. The first few, you're just like, are we rebooting The Wildstorm? What are we doing? And then when they get about, I don't know, a third through it, you're like, oh, this is I won't spoil it for you, but this is exactly what we're doing.
Cool.
So as we wrap this up, we'll talk about artists. Who are your top three artists who you think capture John the way he should be?
Well, you can't discuss Constantine artists without mentioning Stephen R. Bissette, John Toliban, and Rick Veitch.
Because
they created him.
Yes.
And before Alan Moore did, I might add.
Yeah.
And their look to me is the definitive one. The guy with the cigarette near his mouth, his face sort of turned down, his eyes up, with the trench coat and the very sting-like face and hair.
It's not very sting-like. It is sting-like.
And
we say sting. I'm not talking about the wrestler. I know you people know that I love wrestling.
No, obviously we're talking about the sword from Lord of the Rings.
Yes, that's exactly it, yeah. Yeah. But, the basis for John Constantine was Sting from the Police.
Yes,
like, that's exactly who he looked like.
Yeah, and after I answer your artist question, I have a pretty cool story about that to tell you. So those three right off the bat, which, well, you said three, so I guess I've already answered it, but there are others. To me, Steve Dillon comes next after them, just because
you can put them in one. They can all be 1.1, 1.2, 1.3.
Yeah. So Bissette, Toliban, Veitch, and then Steve Dillon, and let me think about this for a minute. I don't remember who drew All Our Engines, but I loved it. I loved the art in that.
It wasn't Leonardo Fernandez.
Could have been.
Okay.
Could have. Okay. You know, I actually. Give me one second while we're talking. I actually created an Excel spreadsheet while I was
looking at you.
Well, I needed to while I was doing the it lists all of the creators.
Okay.
When I was doing the DC book, so I'm just going to look this up.
Yeah.
So, but while I'm at it, let me see.
I will say for me, it's the same deal. Like, you're 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, who give you the best representation of John. And then honestly, I love Giuseppe Chemicoli. Like, I love the old man. I love his art in general. But the old man, John, that he drew, I thought was fantastic. And to me,
yes.
Honestly, he never did interiors, but Tim Bradstreet doing the covers, like
Bradstreet's covers are just astonishing.
Yeah. He's the other guy. I know he never did an interior art, but his covers were next level. And the same way with Lee Bermejo.
I also really like Will Simpson's art during the Garth Sinister.
That was good stuff.
He also, I like Sean Phillips. His work on the John Smith issue you mentioned was really good.
Yep, he was great. Sean Phillips, who's still working. Like, some of these guys aren't working as much anymore, but Sean Phillips is hitched his wagon to Ed Brubaker, and those guys putting out Criminal is marvelous.
There's an artist that years ago I would never have mentioned on the list, but now I do. When I was reread everything in preparation for doing the DC book, just because I needed it all fresh in my head,
and so
I could write that chronology at the end. And I found myself reevaluating several of the runs, and two of them in particular are Azzarello and Milligan. And here's why: Azzarello and Milligan's runs I never liked.
I thought
that Milligan really didn't have a good grasp on John, and I felt that Azzarello turned him into a background character in his own story. He was this grinning Cheshire cat of a guy who walked into a story, said boo, and people freaked, and he walked out, and the story kept going.
Okay.
And also, he never wrapped up his major storyline.
No, he didn't.
That were dangling. So one person I would never have thought I would be mentioning is Marcello Fresin.
Oh, yeah, good call.
Because I always equated him with the Azzarello run, but something happened when I reread it this last time. I suddenly started really appreciating Azzarello in a way that I hadn't before.
Who gets to write him again in Batman the Damned, which is coming out here in a little bit. It's Azzarello and Lee Bermejo doing a Batman Constantine story.
Well, when I eventually read the New 52 and Beyond,
this is Black Label. Like, it's not New 52; it's their own high end imprint.
Elseworlds type stuff.
No, it's not Elseworlds, but it's
continuity, right?
It's kind of.
Then I'm going to wait because I want to read it all in order.
That's fair.
But I've always, even when it was coming out, I really enjoyed Azzarello's first story, Hard Time. I thought it was
great story.
And then after that, it kind of, in my opinion, started falling apart because I didn't care about SW Manor and because John walking along the side of a road meeting redneck after redneck wasn't working for me. But that's because I wasn't connecting with the material. I'm not sure it was the material. It might have been me.
Okay.
Because when I read it this time, I suddenly really got caught up in the three Furman brothers. By the way, I don't know if I'm a complete moron, but
didn't
I never
put that together.
I never picked up on a really funny joke involving the Furman brothers, which is ironic given my name. My name is Richard.
Yes.
The three Furman brothers are named Dickie, Richie, and Lucky, but all three of them have the same first name, Richard. I never noticed that they were all named Richard Furman. I don't know how I didn't notice it because it's right there with Dickie and Richie.
Right.
But this time I was like, wait a minute. Lucky's name is Richard. Holy shit, they're all named Richard.
They're all the same.
I don't know how many times I've reread the run, never picked it up.
That's funny.
An idiot.
That's funny.
And especially given what my name is.
Yeah, right.
So something really connected with me with Azzarello. And so this time, instead of being disgusted at the fact that it didn't wrap everything up, I was disappointed.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to know what happened next. Same thing can be said for Milligan. I hated Milligan's run the first
time.
That's
so crazy. I mean, it's crazy to me because that was my entry.
I just felt that John was. If you ever get a chance, reread all of Hellblazer. I know it's a big undertaking.
I am slowly putting together. Obviously, I'm not going to crack those comics out of their sleeves, but I'm slowly putting together the trades.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you have all of them, read them from Delano up to Milligan, and you'll see why I feel this way. Because I'm still not fully sold on him, but I enjoyed him a lot more this time. The problem is this. When you look at the evolution of the character, he starts off pretty clean cut during the Alan Moore days.
Sure.
He has like a three-piece number. He's well manicured and well washed and so forth. He doesn't say fuck every third word.
Right.
He's a classy guy. And through the Delano era, he falls to drug use.
Right.
He starts not giving a shit about his looks. Much like me in the last 5 minutes, he starts using profanity more than he was earlier. He stops shaving. In the course of the Garth Ennis look, he starts wearing shabbier clothes. And over the next several runs, Jenkins' run, the guy's never sober.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So you get into other runs. He starts really falling apart. Then you get to the era of Mike Carey.
Oh, right. You know, that's one of those eras I always forget about.
at the end of Mike Carey, he's decided, you know what? I'm a fucking stupid person.
Yeah.
I have let magic ruin my life for too long. I have let people get hurt. I have done self-destructive behaviors. I'm walking away with this. So he sets fire to the lockup containing all of his stuff. He says a big F you to the magic world and everybody in it at the club, at the Tate Club.
Yep.
And he walks away from it. And when we see him in the, Andy Diggle. We see him in the Andy Diggle run. Andy Diggle has him clean. He's wearing this a very similar outfit that, to what he did in the Alan Moore days. He cleans himself up. He starts showering again. He starts shaving again. He walks away. He stays away from magic. He walks away from drinking. He buys Ravenscar, which has been turned into a hotel. He buys it, fires the staff, excises the demon in it, burns it down, manages to pull the golden boy that had been the half of himself out,
right.
Gets all of the self-destructive nature on, and moves on with his life. So then what does Milligan do?
Goes right back to it.
After that remarkable character evolution, almost immediately has him running around in unwashed clothes,
right.
with his tie half over his head and 3 days of growth, constantly, you know, basically doing the equivalent of taking crack, hanging out with gangsters, you know, snorting his own feet if he can get away with it.
Is that how he met Effie? Was he working with Effie's dad?
Actually, he knew Epiphany going back years ago. Like, their backstory is that years ago when she was a little kid,
right,
he had done some work for Terry Greaves,
right.
And this is one of the creepier things Milligan did. She falls in love with him at age, I think, 9.
She's very young.
She decides, I'm going to marry him.
Is that creepier than his evil twin raping his niece?
Okay, that's pretty creepy.
That's pretty creepy.
But the idea of a 9-year-old wanting sex.
That's also creepy. Yeah, that's fair.
It's creepy, yeah. Right? So, okay, let's face it. He's creepy. I mean, pretty much half of what he does in his run is kind of creepy.
Yeah.
And... that's the idea is that Epiphany runs, falls in love with him very early on. And, she runs into him a few times over the years. One of the biggest problems I have with his run is that his run is not consistent with what came before.
Sure.
You'll see when you see the 30th anniversary book and you get to the timeline, I had a hell of a time placing any backstory Sir Milligan's run anywhere else, because if you go by Epiphany's age, there are scenes where she supposedly ran into John in England during the Azzarello run when he was only in the United States. It's things like that. Like, as a guy who pays attention to this stuff, I found the Milligan run jarring because there are so many times when Milligan gets a history wrong.
I guess when I'm reading the Milligan run, it reminded me of the John from the Ennis run. Like, those two versions of John are kind of similar. They are a little bit. I mean, you know, like the...
That's interesting.
Fast talking, willing to make a deal with just about anything to get myself out of the situation, but always having a bad, like, you think he's a bad guy, right?
I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
You think he's kind of made a deal to sell somebody's soul to get himself out of a situation, but kind of like Sherlock Holmes, there's a back door where he tricks the demon or whatever. Yeah.
I think the other thing is, I have to be honest with you, I was not a fan of the artwork. I'm still not.
Chemical's artwork?
Yeah, and I know that you've praised him a few times. That's cool. That's cool. You know, like, opinions vary, and that's a good thing. I'm all for differing opinions. Otherwise, discussions would go like this. I think this, me too. Okay, right. What do you want to talk about next?
He's actually on the Darth Vader comic now, and it's fantastic. Like, him drawing Vader... is a match made in heaven.
I think sometimes the problem I have with it, with the issues that Ken McCulley and I think what was the other Stefano Landini, I think was the other artist.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, when the two the work that the two of them do, it almost looks to me, and I'm going to have to put a disclaimer at the end of this because it's going to sound like I'm saying something offensive, but I'm going to put a disclaimer that makes it okay.
Okay.
It almost looks like they were having epileptic seizures while drawing it.
My disclaimer
is that my son is epileptic. Okay. It's okay if I say that.
It's all right with me.
Because my son and I have always joked around about it because it makes it easier to deal with. Like, we would say things like, you know, if ever you stop having epilepsy, we're going to do a party. And he would say, yeah, you could serve shakes.
Well done, sir. You know, well done, bud. Like how old this. Is this boy?
Well, he's 16 now. I think he was 13 at the time.
That's a perfect
so,
sense of humor.
He's my son. He has no choice.
We can serve shakes.
So therefore, yeah, we can serve shakes. Yeah. When I say that it almost looks like they were having seizures while drawing it, I don't mean it to make fun of epilepsy. I'm making fun of the way they drew it.
Right. No, I get it. Yeah, right on.
Yeah, yeah. Because it looks like their hands weren't steady. Now, I know that's a stylistic thing,
sure,
and it may work for you, and that's really cool, because I'm sure there are people who can't stand Steve Dillon's work.
Which boggles my mind.
I think they're crazy, but I'm sure they're out there, and that's that's totally a valid way. There are probably people who are on serious
levels. Those people are wrong.
Yeah, exactly. There are probably people who are on major amounts of drugs who don't like Bernie Wrightson's work, but those people we won't talk to.
Yeah,
so
you can go off in your own little QAnon corner and hang out with those guys. We'll talk about the big boys.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not saying that Kevin Coley doesn't have talent, because he does. And in fact,
he worked on
Spider-Man.
That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think that the guy's a talented artist, and it might work for another title for me.
Okay.
I never liked John looking like he was in the process of sitting on a jackhammer.
That's fair.
So, I sound like I'm being unusually harsh.
No. I look like that,
I'm the kind of guy who jokes about everything. It's just the way I am.
No,
so,
I think
I don't
comics,
mean any disrespect to Cam and Coley or anybody else.
Comic books, along with any other art form, are a subjective media. And yeah. I totally understand that Kevin Coley may not be everybody's cup of tea. I mean, there are plenty of artists who I don't like, but they are superstars. So, you know. Yeah, and that's – I mean, did you have anything else artist-wise that you were a fan of?
Let's see.
I know there was one that you were looking up.
Yeah, we've gone so off the mark. Leonardo Manco.
There we go. Yeah, and who is he's also
fantastic. I couldn't remember Manco's first name. That was what I was looking up. I was drawing a blank on his name. Leo Manco's work is amazing. In fact, I'm not a fan of the Denise Mina run. It's the one era of Hellblazer I find very difficult to trudge through.
Yeah.
Manco's work is what gets me through it, because it's not a well-written story, in my opinion, but although I will say this, I think Mina is a very good writer.
She's a fantastic writer.
I think that she has a great gift for Constantine as a character. She had him down. She understood him better than some of the other authors. And the dialogue was often beautiful.
Yep.
But the stories just – they were nonsensical. They made no sense to me. She had started things and didn't finish them. I think that the problem was she was a novelist, not a comic writer, and really didn't know.
You see,
she wasn't good with the medium.
You
right?
see
so
that
I
problem
have,
a lot.
Yeah,
like that is
and
still
so,
a problem.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And so I think, but at the same time, I mean, look at Nancy Collins' Swamp Thing run. I adore
that's
it.
True. That's a good point.
Nancy Collins was a horror writer, still is, and was relatively new to comics. I mean, these days, you know, she's well known for Vampirella and other titles, but when she was relative, as far as I remember, she was relatively new to comics when she came into Swamp Thing, and she gave us Lady Jane.
She did.
I mean, one of the greatest characters in Swamp Thing. So, you know, I should put the disclaimer in that I know Nancy and have actually collaborated with her. So, if I come off like her champion, full disclosure, I should put that in there.
Okay.
Long before I knew her, I was a big fan.
Right.
When Joe gave me the comics, one of the things he had said to me is, you're going to love, as much as you love Moore, you're going to love Collins. And when I read it, I said, this might be my second favorite run.
It's a great run.
So when I eventually got to know her, I was very thrilled, because it turns out that, you know, she was as nice a person as she is a good writer. And I wish that I could say the same thing about Mina's comics. I wish that I could say that the transition from novel to comic was as good as Collins was, but unfortunately I can't, which is why I'm very glad Manco drew them, because Manco, who also drew Diggle's run, part of
he
it.
He did, that's right. That's where I recognize him from.
Yeah, and in fact, Cam and Coley and Landini started They had a couple issues during Diggle as well.
Okay.
But Manco drew most of it, of Diggle, and I think all of Mina.
Okay.
I'm looking down here. There was one by Cristiano Cucina. I hope I'm saying that right.
That's the thing about Hellblazer is you had people working on these books that were no names, but they were – you got a lot of people from 2000 AD. You got a lot of people from Europe coming over and – kill and just like putting American artists to shame.
A lot of people referred to the early years of the Hellblazer run as the comics British invasion.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Back then, you know, we had people like Moore and Gaiman and Delano and these amazing talents that were Hogan, these amazing talents that were transitioning to US comics. And we're better off for it.
We are. I would agree.
We are absolutely better off for it. I think that while Moore is considered the granddaddy of modern comics, and rightly so, there were so many others. Neil Gaiman comes to mind immediately, who came along with him around the same time, who deserve just as much credit.
Yeah, I've always said that to me, the Bible of modern comics is Watchmen. Like, yes. That is but the catcher in the rye is The Dark Knight Returns.
Oh, I like that. The catcher, yeah. Ooh, that's a really good way of putting it.
You know, like, that's the best way
to... Have you trademarked that?
Because I have not.
Okay. But, no, I really like that, I really like that concept. Yeah, absolutely. You just got on my good side, because Catcher in the Rye is one of my all-time favorite novels.
Oh, good, so perfect. Like, that's...
I used to be an English teacher, and I taught...
But yeah, that's where we are. First, I want to say thank you for taking the time out. I know you were a busy man.
Oh, of course.
Getting nerdy about Constantine. So when does the book come out?
I think October. Okay. Oh, and that reminds me, I never did tell you the Sting thing I was going to say.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You'll be glad. I know I'm keeping you on a long time.
No, let's do it.
You'll be glad when you hear this one. It's a cool story. So Alex Gaylor, the editor, had asked me to do these four essays, and then I talked him into somehow extending the book by 30 pages for a chronology. But I guess he trusted my judgment, because what ended up happening next was really pretty damn cool. Alex wrote to me one day saying, you know, we want to find someone to do a foreword for this book, an introduction rather, and everybody has contacted Moore. He doesn't do them, but everyone reaches out to him. Everybody has spoken to Bissett and Delano and Ennis. Everybody has spoken to Todleben. People speak to all the obvious ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, at this point, this is a book celebrating 30 years of Hellblazer pre-New 52. 30 years of Constantine, actually, because there's a couple Swamp Thing stories in there, too. What can you think of that would be out of the box? Who has nobody spoken to that is an oversight?
Well, Gordon.
Well, I'll take it one step further. As almost jokingly, I said, how about Sting?
Yeah, that's well, that, yeah.
And, you know, for those who don't know why we kept making the Sting jokes before, the reason Constantine looks like Sting, it's not a coincidence.
No, it's not.
The trio, Todleben, Bissett, Veach, drew in issue 25 a picture of a guy mugging at the camera. The scene focuses on Abby Hall, and in the midst of all this chaos going on, there's this guy wearing a striped shirt who looks remarkably
yes,
like the police, looking at the camera with a sly grin on his face, because they were major police fans, and so
as I think everybody probably was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of them, and for the life of me, I can't remember whether it was Bissett or Todleben. I want to say Bissett, but if it's Todleben, sorry. But I want to say it was Bissett. Called Alan Moore and said, look, just so you know, we're going to keep drawing this guy. We like the look of this guy. We're going to keep drawing him. You might as well make him a thing.
Right.
And so in 37, Constantine shows up as basically Sting in a trench coat.
Yep.
And there are jokes along the way. Like at one of the later issues, he's in a rowboat called the Gordon Sumner. Like there's things like that are, you know, jokes about Sting, you know.
Yeah.
And Sting in Delano's age actually kind of had a similar background. Like he had a punk rock origin like Sting did and so forth.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so some of the stuff Delano does with him is actually is actually based on Sting's very early pre-Police days.
The only comic book that I have graded and slabbed is my Swamp Thing number 37.
And rightly so.
And it's actually signed by Tolbin and Veitch.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that's a fine. Hold on to that.
It's not going anywhere.
So when I said to him, so half jokingly, how about Sting? And then it was a pause. And Alex says, that's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, but could we get him?
It works in theory, sure.
It works in theory. We could have, you know, in theory we could have John Wayne come back from the dead and do the intro to Preacher.
Right.
But I mean,
right.
In practice, that's not going to happen, right? So can we get Sting do this? I mean, huh? So he goes, all right, well, do me a favor, do some due diligence, find out if Sting knows about this, first of all, because I don't want to approach him to write the intro, at which point he says, I don't give you the rights to like this.
Right, and we're also taking the name.
Not only have to cancel this book, but we have to stop publishing Hellblazer. Right. So I did some due diligence and found an interview going back to a few years after Hellblazer launched. And in it, someone asked Sting, are you familiar with the comic? And he said, oh yeah, I'm familiar with it. I have only glimpsed at it. I think it's really cool. I think it's really cool. It kind of mirrors some aspects of my youth, but not a lot. I want to stress that they're not writing Sting; they're writing John Constantine. And he must have said that like five times in an interview, because he was, for legal reasons, making it clear,
I'm not this guy.
I am not an asshole, a cultist who gets people killed. Moreover, while I am not condemning it, I'm also not putting my seal of approval on it.
Correct.
But the point is, the door was open because he knew about it. He had never shut them down in the last 30 years, and he'd even said, it's cool. So I sent this to Alex, who said, ah, excellent. So he reached out to Sting's publicist and said, now that he was relieved that Sting wasn't going to suddenly say, what, I knew nothing about this.
You know, yeah, right.
Shut down now. So Sting's pub, we figure, you know, we've got months during which I'm doing all the writing on this book and so forth. There's time for hopefully Sting's publicist to eventually notice the email. But as any of us who have ever tried reaching out to to famous people's PR people know, it is not an easy thing. I used to interview people for magazines, and like if I needed to reach a celebrity, someone on Star Trek, for example, it was hit or miss. I could go through the Screen Actors Guild or through some other source to get their agents or reps info, but there was a really good chance I'd never speak to this person because the rep would decide this is beneath him, and the star would never even know I'd reached out.
Oh, I see.
Right? Because they're the buffer. You can't just go, I'm going to go look up Ricardo Montalban's phone number. But you can find out who Ricardo Montalban had as a rep and call the rep.
Right.
And then if the rep says, oh, this sounds like something interesting, let me take it to Ricardo. If not, Ricardo will never know that you even reached out.
And so it's
entirely possible that Sting will never know this request was made. But Alex reached out to the rep. The next day, I think,
rep
gets back and says, yeah, Sting would love to do this. Can you do us a favor? So, like, that,
that's
like,
so awesome. That's so awesome.
Me making this little joke, like, a day or two later, Sting was writing the intro to the book. And then, so they said, can you do me a favor? Can you, Sting is familiar with the character only in cursory. Can you send whatever materials you have and he'll familiarize himself? So, Alex was like, Yeah, of course. So the two of us came up with, like, here's the stories everybody should read about Sting. I mean about Constantine.
It's funny that Sting has his foot in, like, the two worlds that I love the most. So obviously he's the basis for Constantine, but there's also a wrestler that has the same name who is the wrestler in question is the guy that I was my introduction to wrestling. When I see the blonde flat top and the crazy face paint, I was like, not the Ultimate Warrior, mind you. This is a different guy. But yeah, like, he's even had, you know, and then that version of the wrestler Sting goes back to the comic books because he started dressing like the Crow.
Well, if you're also a Lord of the Rings fan, then you've got all the Stings covered.
I'm not, but...
So Alex sent Sting's rep all of the materials, and we figured, I mean, nobody in their right mind, let alone a famous musician who's very busy, can sit and read 300 plus issues.
Sure.
A week later, the introduction shows up.
That's insane.
A week later. And here's the crazy thing. He clearly read stuff because he wrote it in character as the Golden Boy.
No.
He took the stance, and I got to be careful what I say because I don't want to give anything away.
That's fair.
But Sting, after he turned it in, Sting actually posted online a video of himself in John Constantine cosplay announcing he was writing the intro as the Golden Boy.
Son of a bitch.
So I'm not giving anything away because he revealed that. But he decided I'm not just going to write a thing about. Constantine is not me, but he's cool.
Right.
He says, I'm the Golden Boy, and writes a fiction piece.
This is mind-boggling.
Mind-boggling, right?
Yeah.
So this is why I said you'll be glad you stuck around. We stuck around for this part of the conversation, because a joke, what about Sting, a week later ended up with Alex practically having fits because he's holding in his hand the printout of an article – I mean, of an in-universe thing written by Sting as the Golden Boy that's going to be the centerpiece of this book.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was pretty wild. And when he told me, I just sort of, like, in a very Wile E. Coyote manner, my jaw hit the floor.
Yeah, I don't blame you. At all.
So. Yeah, so it was pretty wild. And I could take claim for making the joke. I can't take claim for reaching out and making it happen because Alex did that.
No, that's awesome.
I'm amazed that like Alex's response, oh my god, that's brilliant, kind of sums up why it's something that's amazing. How is it nobody ever thought to reach out to him before?
The one guy. Like that.
I found one interview. It was somebody was interviewing him about something else, and it came up. So, and that was decades ago. So how is it no one thought to go
after him?
We're having a book about, you know, Hellblazer, about comics in general, or about the occult. Why don't you do the forward because you're Constantine? It's amazing to me that that's never happened before.
It's flabbergasting, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think maybe people might have always been afraid, as Alex was, that Sting was going to say, not only am I not willing to do this, but cease and desist. I mean, that might be the reason why.
That could very well be possible. That's true.
That's true. Yeah.
So when the book comes out, and did you say when it was coming out?
I at this point, I don't remember anything I said.
How about when's the book coming out?
Hey, I'm glad you asked. I think that it comes out in October, but it could be November.
And where can they find it?
It's either October or November. Well, I mean, it's being mass produced by DC Comics, so any bookstore should have it. Comic shops should have it. Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com certainly would have it. And I am positive, because nobody thinks you should give business to nobody thinks you should give all the business to Amazon. I am positive that your local bookstore can get it for you.
So can they order it from Diamond at their local shop?
I would have to think so, simply because Diamond carries DC titles. I would think so. I would be surprised if not.
Okay, very good. And where can the folks find you online if you want that to be told?
They can find me skulking around in the corners, lifting up rocks and seeing. No, they can find me on Facebook. Just look for if there's multiple Rich Hanleys, look for the dork holding up a Planet of the Apes anthology with his own name on it and grinning like an idiot.
There it is. And
if you you can find me at HassleinBooks.com, HassleinBooks.com, which was an independent book company that I was running until my partner on it passed away. But the site still exists and the books are still there. Just no new titles.
There it is.
And they can email me at info@HassleinBooks.com. I'm a pretty approachable guy because I'm humble enough to realize nobody wants to approach me.
See? And that's where you're wrong, because I did. As soon as I heard a Hellblazer book was coming out, I was like, I need to talk about this. This needs to happen. And also, so like we said, you can, at the top of the show, you can follow Real Spoilers at Real Spoilers. That's Real with two E's. You can also follow me on Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21. Don't forget to check out the Patreon account. Donate $5. You'll get some special content go along with that. And don't forget to rate and review. That's really important for us to keep us going and keep us kind of relevant. Rich, I want to thank you again for taking the time out. We went just about as nerdy as I thought we were going to get.
I'm pretty sure there might be a topic or two somewhere in the cosmos we didn't cover,
maybe,
but I'm hard-pressed to find it.
If there is, it's not worth talking about.
Right. Exactly. Clearly not.
Yeah, right.
But, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun, yeah. And I'm always happy to come back if you ever want me to, because obviously we don't have a shortage of things to talk about.
No, that's true, we don't. And that'll do it for this episode. All right, guys, appreciate it, and we'll see you later.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.